Chapter 121. That the divine law directs man according to reason as regards things corporeal and sensible. Just as the human mind can be raised to God by corporeal and sensible things, provided one make right use of them for God's honor, even so their abuse either wholly withdraws the mind from God, if the will place its scent in lower things, or distracts the mind's intention from God, when we are to attach to those things. Now, the divine law was given chiefly that man might adhere to God. Therefore it belongs to the divine law to direct man in his love and use of corporeal and sensible things. Again, just as the mind of man is subordinate to God, so is the body subordinate to the soul, and the lower powers to reason. Now, it belongs to divine providence, which God sets before man under the form of the divine law, that everything should retain its order. Therefore man should be directed by the divine law, in such wise that the lower powers be subject to reason, the body to the soul, and external things be employed for man's needs. Further, every law that is framed or right, is conducive to virtue. Now, virtue is the reason's rule applied to both interior affections and the use of corporeal things. Therefore this should be prescribed by the divine law. Moreover, every lawgiver should legislate for those things that are necessary for the observance of the law. Since, then, the law is proposed to the reason, man would not obey the law, unless all that is in man be subject to reason. Therefore it is for the divine law to command that all that is in man be subject to reason. Hence it is said, Romans 12, 1, your reasonable service, and this is the will of God, your sanctification. Hereby we refute the error of those who assert that there is on sin unless our neighbor be injured or scandalized. Chapter 122. How, according to the divine law, simple fornication is a sin and that matrimony is natural. Hence it is clear how futile is the reasoning of those who say that simple fornication is no sin, for they say, take, for instance, a woman who is not bound by the marriage tie, or under any authority, paternal or otherwise. If with her consent, a man have intercourse with her, he does her no wrong since she pleases herself, and has the disposal of her own body. He does not wrong a third party because, in the supposition, she is under no one's authority. Therefore there is no sin, nor, seemingly, is it enough to reply that he does a wrong to God. Because we do not wrong God unless we wrong our own good as stated above. But this would not seem to be contrary to man's good. Consequently no wrong, seemingly, is done to God thereby. Likewise, it would not seem to meet the case if one reply that the man wrongs his neighbor by scandalizing him. For one may be scandalized at something that is not a sin in itself, so that it becomes a sin accidentally. But the point at issue is whether simple fornication be a sin, not accidentally, but in itself. Accordingly we must seek the solution from what has been said above. For it has been stated, that God cares for everything in respect of what is good for it. Now, it is good for everything that it obtain its end, and its evil is that it turn from its end. This applies to the parts as well as to the whole, so that man's every part, even as his every act, should attain to its due end. Now, though the seed be superfluous for the preservation of the individual, it is necessary for the propagation of the species. Other superfluities such as excretions, urine, sweat and the like are not necessary for anything, and so it is only their discharge that is good for man. Seed, however, has another end in view, since it is emitted for the purpose of generation, which is the object of coition. Moreover, generation would be in vain, if due nourishment were not to follow, because the offspring would not survive if deprived of its due nourishment. Hence the emission of seed should be ordered in such wise, that befitting generation and rearing of the offspring may follow. It is therefore clearly contrary to man's good that the seed be emitted in such a way that generation cannot ensue, and if this be done deliberately it must needs be a sin. I mean, if it be done in a way that is directly opposed to generation, such as every emission of seed without the natural union of male and female. Hence sins of this kind are said to be against nature. If, however, it be accidental that generation cannot ensue, It is not on this account contrary to nature, or sinful. For instance, if the woman be sterile, in like manner it must be contrary to man's good, if, though seed be omitted so that generation can ensue, the proper upbringing of the offspring is hindered. For it must be observed that in those animals in which the female alone suffices for the rearing of the offspring, dogs for instance, the male and female do not remain together after coition. On the other hand, in all cases in which the female does not suffice to rear the offspring, the male and female remain together after coition, as long as may be necessary for the rearing and development of the young. We have an instance of this in certain birds, whose young are unable to seek food as soon as they are hatched. For since the bird does not feed its young on milk, which is ready at hand through being prepared by nature, as in the case of quadrupeds, and needs to go in search of food for them, and besides this fosters them by incubation, the female alone would not suffice for all this. Wherefore divine providence has given the male of such animals the natural instinct to remain with the female for the rearing of the offspring. Now it is clear that in the human species the female is far from sufficing alone for the rearing of the children, since the needs of human life require many things that one person alone cannot provide. It is therefore in keeping with human nature that the man remain with the woman after coition, and not leave her at once, indulging in promiscuous intercourse, as those do who have the habit of fornication. Nor is this argument weakened because some woman has sufficient means to rear her offspring by herself, because natural rectitude in human acts depends not on what is accidentally in one individual, but on that which is proper to the whole species. Again, we must observe that, in the human species, the offspring needs not only nourishment for its body, as with other animals, but also instruction for its soul. For other animals have their natural forethought which enables them to provide for themselves, whereas man lives by reason, which can attain to forethought only after long experience, so that children need to be instructed by their parents who are experienced. Moreover, children are not capable of this instruction as soon as they are born, but only after a long time, and especially when they reach the age of discretion. Besides, this instruction requires a long time, and even then, on account of the assaults of the passions whereby the judgment of prudence is perverted, they need not only instruction but correction. Now a woman is insufficient for these things. In fact, there is more need for a man for such things, for his reason is more perfect for instruction, and his arm is stronger for punishment. Consequently, a short space of time such as suffices for birds is not sufficient for the education of the offspring in the human species, and a great part of life is required for the purpose. So that, as in all animals it behoves the male to remain with the female as long as the father is needed by the offspring, it is natural in the human race that the man should have not a short-lived but a lasting fellowship with a definite woman, and this fellowship is called matrimony. Therefore matrimony is natural to man, and the intercourse of fornication, which is apart from matrimony, is contrary to man's good. For this reason it must needs be a sin. Moreover, the emission of seed without the requisite intention of procreation and education must not be thought a slight sin, for that it is a small sin, or none at all, to use some part of one's body for some other purpose than that for which nature intended it. For instance, if one walk on one's hands, or use one's feet to do what the hands should do, because by such like actions man's good is not prejudiced very much, whereas the inordinate discharge of semen is perversive of a natural good, which is the preservation of the species. Wherefore, after the sin of murder, whereby human nature is deprived of actual existence, this kind of sin, whereby the generation of human nature is hindered, holds, seemingly, the second place. The foregoing conclusions are confirmed by divine authority, that the discharge of semen in such wise that no offspring can ensue, is unlawful, is clear from the words of Levit 18, 22, 23, "Thou shalt not lie with mankind as with womankind, thou shalt not copulate with any beast," and of 1 Corinthians 6, 10, nor the effeminate, nor liars with mankind, shall possess the kingdom of God. Again, that fornication and all intercourse with other than one's own wife is unlawful, is evident from the words of Deuteronomy 23:17. There shall be no whore among the daughters of Israel, nor whoremonger among the sons of Israel, and of Job 4:13. Take heed to keep thyself, from all fornication, and beside thy wife never endure to know a crime, and of 1 Corinthians 6:18 fly fornication. Hereby we exclude the error of those who denied that there was a greater sin in the omission of seed than in the discharge of other superfluities, and of those who said that fornication is no sin. Chapter 123. That matrimony should be indissoluble. If one consider the matter rightly, it will be seen that the foregoing arguments not only show that the fellowship of male and female in human nature, which we call matrimony, should be lasting, but also that it should endure throughout life, for possessions are directed to the preservation of the natural life, and since the natural life which cannot be preserved in the person of an undying father is preserved, by a kind of succession, in the person of the son, it is naturally befitting that the son succeed in things belonging to the father. Therefore it is natural that the father's care for his son should endure to the end of his life. If, then, the father's care for his son causes, even among birds, the continued fellowship of male and female, the natural order demands that in the human species father and mother should remain together to the end of life. It would seem also contrary to equity for the aforesaid fellowship to be dissolved, for the female requires the male, not only for procreation, as in other animals, but also for governance, because the male excels both in intelligence and in strength. Now, the woman is taken into partnership with the man for the purpose of procreation. Consequently, when the woman ceases to be fruitful and fair, this is an obstacle against her being taken by another man. Hence, if a man, after taking a wife in her youth, while she is yet fair and fruitful, can put her away when she has aged, he does her an injury, contrary to natural equity. Again, it is clearly unfitting that the woman be allowed to put away the man, since she is naturally subject to the man's authority, and one who is subject to another is not free to withdraw himself from his authority. Hence it would be contrary to the natural order if a wife could leave her husband. Consequently, if the husband could leave his wife, there would not be just fellowship between husband and wife, but a kind of slavery on the part of the latter. Also, there is in man a certain natural anxiety to be assured of his offspring, and this is necessary, because the child needs the father's authority for a long time. Hence, whatever prevents him from being assured of having children is contrary to the natural instinct of the human species. Now, if the husband may put away his wife, or the wife leave her husband, and take another man, thus being copulated first to one, and afterwards to another, the certainty of offspring would be hindered. Therefore it is contrary to the natural instinct of the human species that husband and wife be separated, and in consequence the union of male and female in the human race must be not only long-lasting but indissoluble. Moreover, the greater the friendship, the more stable and lasting is it. Now, seemingly between husband and wife there is the greatest friendship, for they are made one not only in the act of carnal intercourse, which even among dumb animals causes an agreeable fellowship, but also as partners in the whole intercourse of daily life, so that, to indicate this, man must leave father and mother for his wife's sake. Therefore it is right that matrimony should be altogether indissoluble. It must also be observed that among natural acts generation alone is directed to the common good, since eating, and the discharge of other superfluities, regard the individual, whereas procreation regards the preservation of the species. Hence, as the law is made for the common good, whatever regards procreation should be regulated, before other things, by laws both divine and human. Now positive laws should be based on natural instinct, if they be human, even as in demonstrative sciences, all human discoveries must needs be founded on principles naturally known. And if they be divine, not only do they express the instinct of nature, but they also supply the defect of natural instinct even as the things that God reveals are beyond the grasp of natural reason. Since, then, the natural instinct of the human species is that the union of male and female be indissoluble, and that one man be united to one woman, it behoved this to be ordered by human law. Moreover, the divine law adds a kind of supernatural reason taken from the representation of the indissoluble union of Christ and the Church, which is union of one with one. Wherefore inordinateness in the act of generation not only is contrary to the natural instinct, but it also transgresses laws both divine and human. Hence, this kind of disorder is more sinful than that which may occur in taking food, or in similar things. And since in man all other things should be subordinate to what is best in him, the union of male and female is ordered by law not only in the point of its relation to the procreation of children, as in other animals, but also in its relation to good morals, which right reason regulates, both as regards man in himself, and considered as a member either of a private family, or of the civil community. Now, the indissolubility of the union of male and female belongs to good morals, because their mutual love will be the more constant if they know that they are indissolubly united. They will also be more carefully provident in the conduct of the household, when they realize that they are always to remain together in possession of the same things. Again, this precludes the origin of quarrels which must needs arise between the husband and his wife's relatives, if he were to put his wife away and those who are connected through affinity have a greater regard for one another. Moreover, it removes the occasions of adultery which would occur, were the husband free to put away his wife, or vice versa, for this would encourage the seeking of further marriage. Hence it is said, "But I say to you that the wife depart not from her husband." Hereby we condemn the custom of putting a wife away. Nevertheless, this was permitted to the Jews in the old law by reason of the hardness of their heart, because, to wit, they were prone to wife murder. Hence the lesser evil was allowed, in order to avoid the greater. Chapter 124. That matrimony should be the union of one man with one woman. It is also to be observed, seemingly, that all animals that are used to copulate have a natural instinct to resist another's intercourse with their consort, wherefore animals fight on account of copulation. And as regards all animals, there is one common reason for this, because every animal desires to indulge at will in the pleasure of copulation, even as in the pleasure of eating, and this freedom ceases if many males have access to one female, or vice versa. Just as an animal is deprived of the free enjoyment of its food, if another animal despoil it of the food it desires to consume. Hence animals fight both for food and for copulation. But with regard to men, there is a special reason, because, as already stated, man naturally desires to be assured of his offspring, and this assurance would be altogether nullified in the case of promiscuous copulation. Therefore the union of one man with one woman comes from a natural instinct. A difference, however, is to be noted here. For as regards one woman not being united to several men, both the foregoing arguments avail. But as regards one man not being joined to several women, the second argument is of no use, since the certainty of having offspring is not removed if one man be joined to several women. The first argument, however, avails against this, for just as freedom of access to the woman is denied if she have another man, so too the same freedom is denied the woman, if the man have several women. Hence, as certainty of having offspring is the chief good sought from marriage, no human law or custom has permitted polyandry. This was considered to be wrong even among the ancient Romans, of whom Maximus Valerius, that they deemed that not even on account of barrenness should the marriage bond be severed. Again, in every animal species where the father has a certain care for his offspring, the one male has but one female, as may be seen in birds, where both unite in feeding their young, for one male would not suffice to rear the progeny of several females. On the other hand, where the male animal has not the care of the offspring, we find indifferently union of one male with several females, or of one female with several males. Such is the case with dogs. Hence, and so forth. Since then, of all animals, the male of the human species is preeminent in the care of his offspring. It is clearly natural to man that one man should have one wife and vice versa. Besides, equality is a condition of friendship. Hence, if a woman may not have several husbands, because this removes the certainty of offspring, were it lawful for a man to have several wives, the friendship of a wife for her husband would not be freely bestowed, but servile as it were. And this argument is confirmed by experience, since where men have several wives, the wives are treated as servants. Further, in perfect friendship it is impossible to be friends with many, according to the philosopher. Hence, if the wife has but one husband, while the husband has several wives, the friendship will not be equal on either side, and consequently it will be not a freely bestowed but a servile friendship as it were. Moreover, as we have already stated, matrimony among men should be so ordered as to be consistent with good morals. Now it is contrary to good morals that one man have several wives, for this leads to discord in the family, as shown by experience. Therefore it is not right for one man to have several wives. Hence it is said, Genesis 2:24, they shall be two in one flesh. Hereby polygamy stands condemned, as also the opinion of Plato said that wives should be possessed in common, which opinion was adopted by Nicholas, one of the seven deacons. Chapter 125. That marriage should not be contracted between relatives. For these reasonable motives the laws have decreed that certain persons belonging to a common stock should be debarred from marriage. Because, as marriage is the union of different persons, those who should consider themselves as one through having a common ancestor, are rightly debarred from marriage, that they may have a greater regard for each other, through realizing that for that reason they are one. Again, since in the relations between husband and wife there is a certain natural shame, relations should be forbidden between those who through being united in blood should revere each other. This motive seems to be indicated in the law, where it is said, thou shalt not uncover the nakedness of thy sister, and so on. Further, that men be too much given to the pleasure of copulation is corruptive of good morals, because, since, more than any other, this pleasure absorbs the mind, the reason would be hindered in things pertaining to rectitude. Now there would result an abuse of pleasure if man were allowed to be united in copulation with those in whose society he must needs live, such as sisters and other relatives, for it would be impossible to remove the occasion of intercourse with such persons. It was therefore in keeping with good morals that the law should forbid such unions. Moreover, the pleasure of copulation corrupts entirely the judgment of prudence. Therefore frequency of that pleasure is contrary to good morals. Now, this pleasure is increased by the mutual love of those who are thus united. Hence it would be contrary to good morals for relatives to marry, for then there would be in them the love arising from community of blood and nourishment, in addition to the love of desire, and, in consequence, through multiplicity of loves the soul would be all the more a slave to pleasures. Besides, it is most necessary in human society that friendship be among many. Now friendships among men are multiplied if marriage be contracted between persons of different stock. Therefore it was becoming for the laws to direct that marriage be contracted with those of different stock, and not between relatives. Also, it is unsuitable that a person be united socially with those to whom he should naturally be subject. Now, it is natural for a man to be subject to his parents. Therefore, it is unfitting for one to marry one's parent, since marriage is a social union. Hence it is said, no man shall approach to her that is near of kin to him. Hereby stands condemned the custom of those who contract bonds of the flesh with persons of their kindred. We must observe, however, that just as the natural inclination is to what occurs most frequently, so too is the law made to fit the majority of cases. The foregoing arguments are not invalidated by any possible exceptions, for the good of many should not be foregone for the sake of the good of one, since the common good is ever more godlike than the good of one. Lest, however, a defect that may occur in a single instance be altogether irremediable, lawgivers and the like have the power to dispense in the statutes that are made for the generality, according to the requirements of a particular case. If the law be made by man, those who have the same power can dispense therein. But if the law be of God, dispensation can be granted by divine authority, just as in the old law polygamy, concubinage and divorce were seemingly allowed by dispensation. Chapter 126. That not all carnal intercourse is sinful. Just as it is contrary to reason to indulge in carnal intercourse so as to frustrate the begetting and rearing of children, so is it in keeping with reason to make use of it in a manner consistent with procreation and upbringing. Now, the divine law forbids only those things that are contrary to reason, as we have shown above. It is unreasonable to say that all carnal intercourse is sinful. Again, since the members of the body are instruments of the soul, the end of each member, as of any other instrument, is its use. Now, the use of certain members of the body is carnal intercourse, therefore carnal intercourse is the end of certain members of the body. But that which is the end of any natural thing cannot be evil in itself, since that which is according to nature is directed to an end by divine providence, as stated above. Therefore carnal intercourse cannot possibly be evil in itself. Further, natural inclinations are implanted in things by God, who moves all things. Therefore the natural inclination of a species cannot be to that which is evil in itself. Now, in all perfect animals there is a natural inclination to carnal intercourse. Therefore carnal intercourse cannot be evil in itself. Moreover, that which is a necessary condition for something good and very good is not evil in itself. But the preservation of the animal species cannot be enduring except by means of generation by carnal intercourse. Therefore carnal intercourse cannot be evil in itself. Hence it is said 1 Corinthians 7:28, a woman sins not if she marries. Hereby we refute the error of those who say that all carnal intercourse is unlawful, wherefore they utterly condemn matrimony and nuptials. Some of them are led to this assertion because they believe that bodies were made not by a good but by an evil principle.